So this is the book I've been reading from for this study. It's called The Book of Isaiah and God's Kingdom, a thematic theological approach. Chapter 1 starts in Isaiah 6, focusing on the exalted title of king, before even really looking at the kingdom itself. So if you have your Bible handy, please open it up to Isaiah 6, because that's what we will be looking at this morning. All right. In chapter 1 of the book of Isaiah and God's Kingdom, the author Andrew Abernathy begins by emphasizing our need to understand God as more than a friend. Now, a friend he is, most definitely. In the book of John, Christ states, "Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends." And true to form, God follows his word with deed by sacrificing his only son to save a wayward kingdom. In this act of sacrificial love, we see God as the truest of friends, and there is much comfort in this. But to quote the author, "I have found that a regular diet of passages that speak of God's transcendence expands my view of God and reminds me that the God who is near is also the holy King of the universe." To communicate this vital idea of God as a transcendent sovereign over all creation, the author focuses on four key passages within Isaiah 1 through 39. They are Isaiah 6, 24 through 25, 33, and 36 through 37. Now, that's a broad spread of passages there. So today we're just going to kind of focus on Isaiah 6. But within these passages, the prophet Isaiah utilizes different literary forms to impress Yahweh's kingship upon our hearts and minds. A palatial vision in Isaiah 6, poetry in chapters 24, 25, and 33, and a historical 8th century perspective in chapters 36 and 37. And like I said, today we're just going to look at Isaiah 6. That's a pretty heady passage if you're familiar with it. So let's look at that and look at the king now and to come. As the author notes, the book of Isaiah wants to humble us before God's throne from the start. In chapter 6, which many of us are familiar with, we see through Isaiah's vision how humbling it is to be ushered before the holy king. Can someone please read Isaiah 6, 1 through 7 for me? Thank you. That was a big chunk. Thank you. So if we look at just the first verse of this reading, what strikes you considering God's royalty or kingship? Just within the first verse, what jumps out at you? We see him on a throne, right? Kind of an obvious position for a king upon his throne. But even before that, what do we see? Something's contrasted here. The very beginning. We've got two kings, right? We've got King Uzziah. He's an earthly king. And his reign has come to an end because he has come to an end. His rule has only been transient. But as God is the eternal Alpha and Omega, his kingship will have no end, as he has no end. In Luke 1:33, speaking of the coming birth of Christ, who is God incarnate, the angel Gabriel states, "And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." So a king who has no end will have a kingdom that will never cease to exist. What else do we see that's obvious that speaks to God's majestic nature? As Ron said, he's sitting on a throne. He's high and lifted up. And Isaiah isn't the only place we see God seated on a throne. In Psalm 47:8, God reigns over the nations. God sits on his throne, his holy throne. In Lamentations 5:19, "But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations." These verses highlight God's throne as the seat of all power and dominion. But Isaiah reveals the throne as something more. The holy seat is a place for exacting judgment. As the author quotes another scholar, God's throne is specifically associated with his role as judge. if we again turn to the Psalms, we see God's throne revealed as a place of judgment. Can someone read Psalm 9:4 for me, please? Or turn to Psalm 9:4. And if someone else could turn to Psalm 9, 7, and 8 and read that next. Yes, you will get participation points for this as well. Psalm 9:4 and Psalm 9, 7, and 8. Sorry, Ron. Go ahead. And Psalm 9, 7, 8. So we see the throne as kind of a seat of judgment here. And that's what the author is getting at. Also in Psalm 122, 5, we see David exacting earthly judgment by way of the throne. There, thrones for judgment were set, the thrones of the house of David. So to quote the author, Isaiah's vision of the Lord sitting on a throne is not a generic statement that Yahweh is king. Fundamental to this vision is that the king is about to exact judgment. And the seraphim, these winged creatures, symbolize this judgment that is about to take place. Does anyone else know where we see seraphim in the Old Testament? In the tabernacle? Okay. I'm thinking of the cherubim in the tabernacle, but possibly. Maybe. Where's Pastor Jesse? In Numbers 21, we see seraphim, snake-like creatures sent by God exacting judgment on the people of Israel through their deadly bite. Also, the author notes that the verbal root of seraph is serap, which means to burn and brings to mind judgment as well. These creatures are more than agents of judgment, though. What do we see one of them doing in verses 7 and 8? From what we just read there. Actually, we didn't. Did we go all the way to 8? Look at verse 7. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." The seraphim is sanctifying the unclean prophet so that we see that they are also guardians of what is holy, the protectors of the sancta, as the author puts it. So up to verse 7, what has been described in some detail through Isaiah's vision? If we look at that, we see that the throne is high and lifted up, revealing just how high and exalted God is. What else do we see? If we look at there in verse 1, besides the throne, what else do we see? What other object is there that kind of speaks to God's royalty? The train of his robe, right? Okay. And it's just merely the hem is what the train is. It's the hem of God's robe is filling the entire temple. And that kind of ties into God's glory filling up the entire earth. What else do we see? These are all descriptions we're getting. We see the temple, right? It's described in a very palatial way. And who else is introduced here that we've already touched upon? The seraphim, right? The snake-like creatures with six wings, okay, who reflect judgment and protect what is holy. So these are all the way Isaiah is describing this throne room, this temple. Okay, what hasn't been described, really? We've got the throne, the robe that's filling the temple. We've got these seraphim, the protectors of the sancta. What really hasn't been described in any detail? God himself, right? So we're coming to understand God by what is around him. Okay? And the author gives no direct description to us of Yahweh. We see the seraphim, the lofty agents of judgment and the protectors of God's holiness, but they themselves do not see God. With their wings, they've hidden their faces from his majesty. As the author puts it, Isaiah's vision of Yahweh as king, Isaiah's vision is of Yahweh as king, though with characteristic Hebrew reserve, The account makes no attempt to depict Yahweh in himself, for Yahweh is primarily depicted by what is seen and said around him. We learn about the king by sensing the need of being shielded from his person and by considering the splendid yet alarming features around him. This brings to mind Moses and his plight as he's desiring to see God's glory in Exodus. In Exodus, Moses says, "Please show me your glory." And he, God, says, "I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he says, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live." God's answer to Moses' request is to place him within the cleft of a rock for protection and only allow his backside to be revealed as he passes by. As we return to Isaiah 6, verse 3, the shout of the seraphim reinforces the nature of the one who is upon the throne. "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." This pronouncement that God is three times holy does more than merely set him apart from those who are not, namely us. As the author says, holiness is a quality that belongs exclusively to God, whereby the holiness of any other person or object is derivative from being in relation to the Holy One, the source of holiness. By declaring that Yahweh is thrice holy, the seraphim are exclaiming that not only are they in danger while in his presence, as evident in their covering of their eyes and feet, but they are moved to extol him because of it. What is Isaiah's response to the seraphim's proclamation? Does he proclaim Yahweh as holy as well? Not immediately, right? As the temple shakes and is filled with smoke, a dreadful smoke likely similar to what enveloped Mount Sinai, Isaiah says, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Through this vision, Isaiah is not caught up in some meditative awe, as the author puts it. He's petrified. He has seen the Lord, and now it's time to die. This is what the prophet has immediately come to understand. And he knows that, as a prophet of God, if he is shortly to be doomed, Israel is not far behind in judgment. But just as God protected Moses, he also protects Isaiah. In a redeeming turn of events, a seraphim is sent to the prophet and touches his lips with a burning coal. This act signifies the expiation of Isaiah's sin. The seraphim states, "Behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for." So with Isaiah's cleansing, one might believe that things are soon to turn around for the prophet and Israel. But as we shift from a vision to a message, we realize that this is not the case. Can someone finish off Isaiah 6 for me? Another long stretch of passage, 8 through 13. Thank you, Ron. So as we move from seeing to hearing, the plight of God's people is evident. Through what he has heard from God, Isaiah is now commissioned to speak such things to Israel, who, unlike the prophet, will neither hear nor see. The author states, judgment is set against this people. In fact, when Isaiah asks the Lord how long the people are condemned to unreceptivity, the answer is bleak. It will last until cities, houses, and land become desolate. It is fixed. The holy Lord is bent on bringing desolation and exile to his people and his land. The danger Isaiah sensed when he saw the king will become a reality, and he will participate in the process as a prophet who hardens the people. There is a holdout for hope, though. In verse 13, we see that a once strong and flourishing tree, likened to a terebinth or oak, has been burned and cut down. Only the stump remains. But within this stump resides a holy seed. And just as the trunk of a felled oak tree can produce new green shoots, so will this holy seed bring life to the remnant of Israel. Now that we've looked at Isaiah 6 in its entirety, and this is where I want to try to get a little interaction from you guys, what are some of the kingly or royal titles of God used by Isaiah. Take a second to kind of scan 6 and see if you recognize any sovereign titles that jump out at you. King, right? An obvious royal title. Hemelech is the word in the original language. Lord of hosts. I skipped my Hebrew class this week, so I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Yahweh Sabaoth. That's in Isaiah 6, 3, and 5. And that is God as Lord over earthly and heavenly armies. That's what Lord of hosts means. And then Lord as well, right? And that's not the replacement for Yahweh in this case. It's Adonai, which denotes a royal or sovereign position. What are some of the surroundings or objects that speak to God's royalty? We've kind of covered that to some degree. The robe, right, where we just have the mere tip of it filling the entire temple. The throne itself, right, that's high and lifted up, this lofty throne of the throne above all other thrones. The seraphim, right, the protectors of the sancta. That was kind of strange for me. I didn't really know who the seraphim were, and so it was surprising to find out that they were winged snakes. I typically associate the serpent with Satan, and so to see these agents of justice or the agents of judgment as created in the image of snakes was kind of a little off-putting for me. But the temple and the house, which is described in a very majestic and palatial manner. Okay, that definitely speaks to royalty, the way Isaiah's vision puts this temple across, or is the way it's described. And what are some of God's royal characteristics in chapter 6? Anything jump out at you? Well, his glory, for one, right? Which will fill the entire earth. And I think I've stated this earlier, just as the train of his robe will fill the temple, so his glory fills the whole earth. This one was interesting to me. Seeking counsel denotes a kingly attribute. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" God being sovereign, we don't typically think of him as one who would need to seek counsel, but within his triune nature, he does that most definitely. And then what the author is really trying to hit home here, and as we have seen, issuing judgment is also a kingly prerogative, which we see in verses 9 through 12. So to cap his study of this portion of Isaiah, the author says, Isaiah 6 is crafted to leave an impression that the holy God reigns as the king and that he has decreed purifying judgment. Isaiah's experience of pardon and the anticipation of a holy remnant, however, shine like dim stars on a dark night. Through this vision of a thrice holy Lord, we can understand what we hear. The judgment has to come now, initially in the 8th century BC context and later in the 6th century BC. Though glimpses of mercy keep embers of hope aflame, even if just barely. So ultimately, what is this hope of Israel? What is our hope? We know that God has kept for himself a remnant, and that this remnant has grown and continues to grow into a vast kingdom, that these few dim stars have brightened and multiply and will someday, according to the promise made to Abraham, be innumerable. But with so many rebels within, how does the king make secure his kingdom? Once again, through sanctifying judgment. He sends his son, the Prince of Peace, as a ransom for his kingdom. Christ, who knew no sin, dons a crown of thorns, is judged and condemned in our stead, so that we should both hear and ultimately see the High King of Heaven seated on his throne of both judgment and grace. With that, let me end with the words of Paul from Hebrews 4:16. Let us therefore come boldly under the throne of grace, or unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need.